out tonight. Tom Ramsey plays bass at Greenwood all the time. Greg playing the hand drums. Yeah. We're starting this week, and I forgot to tell you the announcement, Naomi, but I'll just go ahead and make the announcement. We have books over here, sign-up sheets for the groups that are starting this week. We'll meet Thursday nights at 6:30. The men will meet right across the hall. The women will probably be in the Welcome Center or maybe in the B. Oliver Room. We don't know that quite for sure, but you'll find out if you come. Come through this door here, men and women, come through the Welcome Center door of the sanctuary. But you start at 6:30. Books are over here. They're $5 a piece. You can sign up, grab your book. If you don't have the money, just pay later. But I'd like for our lessons on Sunday night to kind of follow along with where we are in our small groups, in our step groups. And so we want to start with the first lesson. No notes. That's either a very good sign or a very bad sign. You figure it out. Yeah, I don't know if you did pause or not. Anyway, I'm Wendell. I'm loved by God and feeling that love. And I'm recovering from spiritual and emotional abuse and addiction to food and work, and was a hyper-control freak. And I've had issues with pornography, with alcohol, with rage and depression and panic attacks. So the first step, Naomi even referenced it tonight, we admitted we were powerless over our addiction and our lives have become unmanageable. In the 8 steps, we've reworded that just a little bit, but essentially that's what it is. It's an admission of powerlessness over addictions, unmanageableness, issues, demons, whatever it is. Whatever you want to say, we're powerless over that. And so Wayne actually wrote something in his blog. If you're not reading Wayne's blogs, you need to find out how to get on him and read them, because Mr. Deep and Profound is going deeper and more profound because of what he's facing right now. And some of the stuff he's written is just like, what? I knew his waters ran deep, but it's pretty deep. But he's talking about waiting. He was just talking about time and the way we look at time and the way God looks at time. And it hit me, I don't know why, but it hit me about the first step. Think about, and you don't have to share this with anybody, but think about the main issues in your life. Whether it's been substance abuse, relational addiction, spending addiction, codependency, it doesn't matter what it is. But there comes a day when you realize you've got a real problem and you can put your finger on it. It's not some vague thing. You actually can name it. I know what my issue is. I remember when I was like in junior high and high school is the first time I realized this phenomenon, but I didn't really think that deeply about it. How many times do you, not just New Year, but how many times do you make a resolution to stop that? You've put your finger on it. You know what it is. I'm not going to do that. Period. I'm going to quit smoking. I'm going to quit drinking. I'm going to quit porning. Whatever it is. I don't care what it is. You name it. And you make this resolve and you are maybe inspired and bumps you and motivates you. And it's like, this is the time. This is the time. I'm going to quit. I'm not going to do that anymore. And you've got a day under your belt, 2 days under your belt, 3 days under your belt, and boom, there you go again. And so you go through this, I don't know, I'm just going to pick a fairly reasonable number, 50 times. I mean 50 times of really making a hardcore resolution. I am going to stop. This is the time. That was just the sermon I needed to hear. That was just the verse I needed to read. That was just the song I needed to hear on the radio. Whatever. It does it. I went to a seminar. They taught me how to get a handle on this. Blah, blah, blah. You know, this is the time. You resolve. A few days later, boom. So you do this 50 times. I'm just picking that number. You do it 50 times. And for some really weird reason, the 51st time, it sticks. What was with the 51st time, all the 50 times you tried and it didn't work? What is that? And since I've been in recovery, I've heard a whole bucket full of theories well, you just tried harder. Your persistence pays off. Really? I mean, after 50 times, why did 51 work and 50 didn't? I mean, there's something that happens to make it stick that why? And so then I got to thinking, why is it that we hang on to this stuff? Why is it that we medicate with stuff we medicate with, whether it's porn or alcohol or a bad relationship or whatever? We medicate ourselves, or we stay stuck in that. And here, let's go another way with this, okay? Let's go another way. Some of you all are kind of new, might think, whoa, what are we going that way for? Some of us are addicted to religion. Some of us are addicted to legalism. Some of us are addicted to, if I keep all the rules, if I dot all my I's and cross all my T's religiously, it'll be more favorable. If you hang out with Jesus anytime at all, no. He didn't hang out with the religious people. He didn't hang out with the legalistic people. He hung out with what we would call losers. That's who he hung out with. So that doesn't work. But some of us are addicted to substance, porn, smoking, whatever. Others of us are addicted to what much of society would call really legitimate addictions. Oh, you ought to be addicted to the rules. You ought to be addicted to being really religious. Well, Jesus comes and says either one is not a healthy way to live. Neither way is healthy or good. So I got to thinking, why is it that we stay stuck either in what society calls bad addictions or what society calls good addictions? They're all bad. They're all unhealthy. But why do we stay stuck? And it hit me that there are two things that cause us to stay stuck. One is, and if you grew up in church, and if you grew up in any kind of a legalistic type church, or if you just grew up in a home that was really mindful to keeping all the rules and living a certain way, what keeps you stuck in that is this sense, this hyper sense of responsibility. It's my responsibility to be the best person in the room. If nobody else is going to keep the rules, I will keep them. Somebody needs to set the example. Somebody needs to lead the charge and, you know, walk the line and be a perfect person. So I'm just 2 inches away from being perfect, and I'm going to keep trying. So this heavy sense of responsibility that we carry with us, it's bogus, it's silly when you put it that way, but if you've got it, it doesn't feel bogus and silly. It feels natural. It feels like this is the way you're supposed to live. This is the way I lived forever. I lived with this hyper sense of responsibility to be this perfect, good person. And Dr. Phil says, how's that working for you? And I say, it sucked. I could not live that life. Because I would go through the righteous motions with evil intent in my heart. That thing for all the wrong reasons. And the wrongness of the heart always outweighed the rightness of the act. I could do the right things and it never seemed to outweigh what I knew was wrong in my heart. So we stay stuck, especially on these legal addictions. We stay stuck on them because of a hyper sense of responsibility. And we stay stuck on the not so legal addictions out of a sense of panic, out of a sense of dread, out of a sense of a frantic sense of, I've got to protect myself. I have these demons inside me. I have these people I hang out with. They're hurtful. They're dangerous. They are not healthy to be around, and they tear me down, or the demons inside me tear me down. I can't stand to hear the voices. I can't stand to hear the voice of my father berating me. I can't stand to hear the voice of my mother as she walked out on us when we were kids. I can't stand to hear the demons, the voices in your head. And so you say, I've got to do something to shut them down. And so we do it with substance abuse. We do it all kind of ways to shut those voices down. So there's this feeling of drastic self-protection, and then there's this feeling of being hyper-responsible. And these things get all mixed up. Think about if you're a rule keeper. and all of a sudden you find yourself on a slippery slope, and you look back and you say, I've just broken like three or four rules right in a row. Right in a row. Then you realize I'm just as addicted as the people over here, because I'm frantic to get that good righteous feeling back. I'm frantic to restore that. So I've got to do something to try to feel good about myself. So it's all kinds of artificial activities, all kinds of artificial righteousness, all kinds of, you know, we might as well just be mainlining heroin. It's the same thing. We got to get that fixed to make ourselves feel righteous again. And then over here, if you're living this life right on the edge and you feel like, you know, everybody I'm with hurts me, everybody I'm with it brings me down, everybody I'm with wants something from me, and you get in that panic feeling, then all of a sudden you realize there ain't nobody else going to take care of me. There's nobody else going to look out for my welfare. I'm responsible for my welfare. So the people over here who did all this stuff out of a sense of responsibility really aren't different from the people over here who say, ain't nobody else going to take care of me. I'm responsible for that. So I have to, see how they're all mixed up? The responsible people get frantic. The frantic people feel all responsible. So it's all the same thing. And it really goes down to the root of, can't nobody take care of me like me? Can't nobody make me as righteous as I want to be but me? Can't nobody make me feel as safe as I need to feel as me? See? It all comes back to me. And there has to be some point when we can just stop that. There was some cartoon with a dirty cartoon. But remember, if you've ever watched it, they took our jobs. Does anybody remember that cartoon? What was the name of the cartoon? South Through the Room. And there's another place where it's not my job. There comes some place. Voices. So it's like, it's not my job. It's not my job. There comes some place in your life. Maybe for 50 times you say, I'm going to give it over, but you're really not. The 51st time you finally come to the place where you say, okay, this is not my job. This is not my job anymore. It's not my responsibility to protect myself or keep myself safe, and it's not my job to be more righteous than I already am. It's not my job. And what hit me this week was, and I know I say a lot about my dad, but I remember the day that my dad died. I didn't have a good relationship with my dad. Y'all know that. But I remember the day my dad died. And I think nearly everybody was there, weren't they, Robbie? I don't know that there were any family members missing, including all grandchildren. And he's in the bed, and the hospice nurse had asked permission to give him something that would just help him sleep. And if he went to sleep, she knew he would go ahead and pass on. He was just right at death's door. But my father, I mean, you think I'm a control freak. My father was like, he was a control freak. He wanted to control everything, including his own death. He wanted to hyper-manage everything. And so my father, before he would take that medicine that made him go to sleep, asked everybody to come in the room. And he literally went around the room and gave everybody some sort of assignment. You know, some of it was more like a blessing or whatever. But you need to do this. And I was like, Dad, you're allowed to die. You're not responsible for this family anymore. You're not responsible to be in control anymore. And so we literally, it was me and somebody else, I forget who it was, but we literally had to tell my dad, you have permission to die. It's okay to die. Has anybody ever had that with a relative? I've had it several times. Lewis just had to go to Florida. Is it okay to tell that?
Oh, absolutely.
Lewis just had to go to Florida to his only remaining immediate family member, his older sister, who was battling cancer. When Carol was sick, my first wife was sick with cancer. We were in a little country, a parsonage out in the middle of Middle Tennessee, and her parents lived in Marietta, Georgia. And I called him and I said, if you want to see Carol alive, you better get up here and get up here quick. It was about a two-and-a-half-hour drive up from the Atlanta area to where we were. She held on Loretta, why did I get that? Carol held on, literally held on. Every breath was a struggle. Every breath was a struggle. She wasn't coherent, but maybe a few seconds out of every hour. Couldn't talk. She was yellow. Her liver had shut down. She was bloated. She was just raspy and everything. But she held on. I said, "Your mom and dad are coming." I didn't know whether she heard me or not, but she held on. And when they pulled in the driveway out in front of the house, I looked out and I said, "They're here." And I ran out to warn them how bad she, you're not ready for what you're going to see in here. And she died right then. She literally held out until her parents got there. There's something in the human psyche that will fight and fight after everything is shut down. We'll fight and fight to stay alive against all odds. And there's something about our demons and our addictions and our issues that will fight and will fight and will fight to keep them alive. I don't know why. I don't know if it's our identity. I don't know if it gives us a reason to live. If I don't have a positive reason to live, at least I have a negative reason. I don't know. I don't know. But at some point, somebody needs to give us permission to stop. To just die. Not physically, but just die. I can stop trying to impress other people. I can get out of that toxic relationship. I can stop getting shit-faced every night of the week. You get it? At some point where we have permission to just stop. I can quit. And it might be a human voice that says that, but I really think, and this comes back to what I was talking about with Wayne's blog and his thing of waiting, I think God is perfectly good with waiting. God lived outside of time before he made us. God doesn't need time. God doesn't get impatient. Oh, so much time has gone by. He's lived outside of time, so time doesn't mean that much to him. So God will stick with each one of us and stick with us and stick with us and say, "I'm good with the waiting. I'm not going to love you any more or any less when you change. Your change does not make any difference. I'm perfectly happy just to stay right here with you through the first attempt and the second and the third and the fourth and the 40th and the 50th. I'm perfectly willing to stay right here with you through all these failed attempts. And when you're ready, I'm going to either in your spirit or through another human being, when you're ready, I'm going to give you permission to die to all this stuff." And I think it's a cooperative thing. We've always said, well, maybe not we've always said, but kind of the tone of recovery is that's the one decision you make, is to give up. I'm not so sure I believe in that so much anymore. I think it's more of a cooperative thing where God is sitting there saying, "We'll know. Both of us will know. We'll know when it's time, when the right time is." It's a cooperative thing. And God is perfectly good with that. The religion that I grew up in said, as long as you're drinking or drugging or pouring of Jesus or, forget heaven, you're going to burn for eternity in hell. That was the theology I was taught. And now I'm realizing, now I don't believe that anymore. I don't believe that God's love for me is contingent on my behavior or on my perfection. God loves me because I'm his kid. He loves me because I'm one of his favorite kids. And Wayne said this morning, "But so are you." Figure how to do the math on that one. But once I got a hold of that, once I realized that God is not there, just wringing his hands and, "Oh, I just wish that you would take this step. And no, God's not doing that. God is sitting there patiently with you and saying, I'm right here with you. I will love you no more or no less 5 years from now or 50 attempts from now. Doesn't make any difference. I'm your dad. I'm here with you right now, period. And I'm just going to hold you. And we will know when the time is for this issue to die in you. We will both know when the time is. And we'll give it permission to die. And you can move on. So this first step, isn't it kind of weird that with certain issues in our life, the first time you ever went through a step study, you probably gave certain issues up. Certain ones. They're gone. Wow, step studies are great. And then you kind of hung around and you realized, shoot, I got some other ones. You know? And they're not going so easy. They're not leaving so easy as that first set of issues. They're hanging on a little harder. And so that's why we say we're discovering more and more about what's going on inside of us. And so we hang in there. And slowly but surely, God says, okay, now it's time for this one to die. And now it's time for this one to die. And you know. But the thing about it is, we don't have to make that call. I don't have to make that decision. It's not up to me. I'm not even qualified to make that decision. I'm in a cooperative effort with God, and I listen and I watch the best I can, and I have trust that when it's time, I'll know it's time. This time it's going to take. This time it's going to work. Why? Because I decided no, because we did. We did together. So, I don't know, facing this, because I'm going to work these 8 steps. I'm going to be in a group. I'm going to work them myself again. And facing them this time, I think, this sounds so cliched, but it's so true. Every step study we go through, God is in that room working those steps with us. Not as an observer, but as an active participant with each one of us. Think about that. He's not sitting there saying, okay, you're going to make this decision tonight? You're going to do it? Can we get you shoved across some line? He's sitting there saying, no. I'm here. I've got you. Hold on to my arm. We'll take this step together. Are you ready yet? Okay. If you're not, we'll wait. When you're ready, we'll take this step. So he's an active participant. And he's not put off by the waiting. And he's not disappointed with our hesitations. He's just there as our dad who says, we'll know when it's time. See, Dad, we'll know when it's time. I was a pushy dad. I was a demanding dad, especially to my boy, to our boy. He's forgiven me of that. He's my best bud now. But I always thought that's the way God was, pushy, demanding, you know. And I really think he's a little bit more like my grandpa was, just more, let's do this together. You know, let's just go out and do this together. If you don't get it right, that's okay. We'll just do it together. Let's go fishing. Let's go squirrel hunting, whatever. It's okay if you missed it. It's okay if you didn't catch that one. Let's just do it together. And that is so different. That God is so much easier to live with and commune with than the way I was toward Jacob when he was little. It's just different. So I hope this is helpful. This is helpful to me. And it's just kind of part of my story. But God's good with waiting. Thank you, God, that you're good with waiting. Nami?